From the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. About a year and a half ago, a health reporter at the Washington Post named Lenny Bernstein started reporting on the huge number of Americans dying of drug overdoses. His editor had a pretty simple question about how it all started with prescription painkillers.
She came to me and she said, "What I'd like you to do is to explain to people how all those pills got on the street. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Either somebody put them out there or somebody let them go out there." So it was a great question.
Lenny started digging. He didn't know it then, but the story was going to lead him into the halls of power.
To the Justice Department, to Capitol Hill, to the White House, to the drug industry.
The Washington Post assembled a reporting team around the project, including investigative reporter Scott Higham.
Well, I've been a reporter for about 30 years, and it's the swampiest thing I think I've ever seen in Washington.
What they found raises serious questions about our federal government's role in the opioid epidemic, and it takes us deep inside the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA. Later in the show, we're going to hear a very intimate story of one family in the aftermath of an overdose death. But first, we're teaming up with the Washington Post and 60 Minutes to answer the question, why was America flooded with pain pills in the first place? Reveal's Laura Starcheski takes it from here.
When Lenny's editor first gave him this assignment, he started cold calling a ton of people. He was trying to find out, why didn't someone stop the flow of pills?
Finally, someone said to me, "You know, you ought to talk to Joe Ranazzisi. This is what he did until he retired recently."
Joe Ranazzisi had just retired from a position high up in the DEA.
So I called him, and I just lucked out because I caught him at the right time. He had just been pushed out of a job he loved, and that a job where he felt he was making a real difference, really doing something about the deaths that we were seeing on the street. And he was just, you know, explosive. The conversation was explosive. I mean, I couldn't get him off the phone.
Joe wanted Lenny to know about these companies that he said were largely responsible for the opioid epidemic. Not pharmaceutical manufacturers, companies called distributors who actually ship the drugs.
The three big ones are McKesson, AmerisourceBergen, and Cardinal. They control pretty much the whole market.
These distributors make billions every year. They are some of the largest American companies of any kind. But Lenny, a health reporter, knew almost nothing about them.
So Joe was kind of schooling me on this. And he was saying, you know, they are responsible. There are hundreds of millions of opioids on the streets killing people right now that don't need to be there.
I went to the D.C. suburbs to meet Joe Ranazzisi. He came to the door of his townhouse wearing jeans and comfortable shoes. He's got close-cut salt-and-pepper hair and a hound dog named Banjo who wants to jump all over me.
Banjo! No! No jumping!
Joe's got a basement full of paperwork and guitars he keeps meaning to play more.
Too many guitars and not enough time to play guitars. So.
Did you play in a band?
On and off.
I can't really imagine Joe on a stage. He gives off a no-nonsense, street-smart vibe like a seasoned beat cop. He started as a DEA street agent in the 1980s, mostly in Detroit, chasing down dealers.
You could be coming into work in Detroit in the morning and end up in Albuquerque, New Mexico in the afternoon.
He worked on all kinds of cases.
Coke, heroin, weed, club drugs, the party drugs.
He did undercover buys.
It's pretty simple, actually. It's how convincing you are.
And he loved it. Best job he could imagine.
Protecting people. That's what's important. I wanted to make sure that, you know, I did my part.
Along the way, he worked cases where prescription drugs were sold on the street, and he perfected his training so he could go after bigger and bigger fish. Joe has a law degree and a pharmacy degree. In 2006, Joe was promoted to a new position in D.C. at DEA headquarters. He'd be in charge of a special unit called Diversion Control. Not as glamorous as busting heroin rings and making headlines. In fact, it was kind of a DEA backwater.
It was a small unit that did a lot with very little.
Their mission was to keep prescription drugs from ending up in the hands of drug users and dealers. This was just as the opioid epidemic was getting out of control.
Millions and millions and millions of tablets were leaving the pharmacies and going into the communities, and people were overdosing, and it was just a nightmare.
More than 10,000 people would die of prescription drug overdoses that year. So Joe went after the bad doctors, he went after the bad pharmacies, but then he noticed something.
We were noticing that the distributors were sending these huge amounts of drugs into these pharmacies without looking at them, without doing any due diligence, without filing suspicious order reports.
Suspicious order reports. The companies were legally required to report any oddly huge orders to the DEA, but some companies weren't reporting them.
And since they were doing all that, at that point in time, we decided that, you know, we need to take a top-down approach.
Joe decided to go after the distributors sending those truckloads of drugs around the country.
So we're standing in front of a very large Cardinal Health Distribution Center here in Baltimore.
Lenny and I visited this big beige building on the edge of the city to see the distributors in action. Shipping and receiving is behind a big security gate. Trucks are pulling in and out.
These distributors, the wholesale distributors, get the drugs from the manufacturers, the opioids, and they ship them out to the places where you and I consume them. We buy them.
These are high-tech warehouses with sophisticated tracking systems. Cardinal ships all kinds of medicine to hospitals and pharmacies across the country. But not all the pain pills go to people who really need them. The size of the opioid shipments coming out of warehouses like this tells the whole story.
Just to give you a sense of the scale here, between 2007 and 2012, distributors shipped 9 million hydrocodone pills to a pharmacy, a single pharmacy in Kermit, West Virginia, which is a town of 392 people.
Nine million hydrocodone pills for a town of 392 people. If all those pills were really for the people of Kermit, West Virginia, each man, woman, and child would have to take at least 12 pills a day, every day, for those 5 years. At the DEA, Joe had a tool he could use to stop trucks from even leaving the warehouse in a situation like that, an immediate suspension order.
Just think of it this way. An immediate suspension order says, I'm coming into your facility and I'm stopping you from dispensing, distributing, doing anything with controlled substances until we all can figure out what's going on, and we're going to do that before a judge. I don't have to wait a year for a criminal case to go through or for a civil action to go through. I could stop it now.
Joe put the companies on notice. They would be held responsible if pills they shipped ended up on the street. If they didn't follow the law, he'd get an immediate suspension order and stop their shipments. After that, sometimes the company would get slapped with a multi-million dollar fine, which sounds like a lot, but these are Fortune 500 companies.
It just seemed like no one in the industry cared. It's almost like they did a cost-benefit analysis and they said, well, if I can make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars doing this, and I'm only going to be fined $30, $50, $100 million, then what the heck? I mean, we're making all this money, so why don't we just continue? It was mind-blowing.
By 2010, as the opioid epidemic starts to explode, Joe's small legal team is humming. That year, they filed 52 of those immediate suspension orders against doctors, pharmacies, and distributors.
It was really a glorious time because they were just knocking them dead. They were just, like, filing and filing.
Hearing this, I was wondering, how could these distributors just keep on shipping pills? How did they justify it? I asked Lenny.
Have you ever heard, like, a direct explanation from the companies why they weren't reporting the red flags or taking this on in a systematic way?
I've read many explanations because as they would fight these things out in court, they would give their side. So there are volumes in these court cases of the companies saying, well, we have all these sophisticated analytics that look at these drug flow, and we are super cautious about it, and we don't send anything out where we think there's any kind of a problem. And, you know, how can you expect us to know what's going on in 55,000 drugstores that we supply? Some of them are 3,000 miles away, and you're expecting us to know that there's suspicious ordering going on in some little mom-and-pop drugstore in West Virginia, and we try our best.
I asked the Distributors Association, the Healthcare Distribution Alliance, for an interview, but they wouldn't do one. In a statement they put on their website, they say that they never got enough guidance from the DEA about how to follow the law. They sent emails to the Washington Post saying that the epidemic is not their fault, that overprescribing by doctors is the real problem. Joe's team was going after doctors, and pharmacies too, but by 2012, he had his sights set on the biggest distributors. His team found that a Cardinal warehouse was shipping huge orders of oxycodone to four pharmacies in Sanford, Florida. Again, Lenny Bernstein.
The Cardinal case, you know, the average drugstore in the area of Florida that the DEA focused on would hand out like 65,000 doses of oxycodone a year in 2012. And then the ones that they went in and busted, they were doing 2 million. Well, what's going on there?
The pharmacist would fill prescriptions for oxycodone even if a customer used street slang by asking for the M's or the blues. Sanford, Florida attracted dealers from as far away as Kentucky.
So if you had a 30 milligram oxycodone, you might be able to sell that on the street for 30 bucks. So obviously if you had 30 of those, they're worth $900. If you have 300 of those, you know, it's worth $9,000. So that's a lot of money.
This black market gave new meaning to the term drugstore.
It's just what you would think. There's a drugstore, and then there's a line out the door. It fills the lobby. I mean, think of the last time you went to the drugstore, right? Was there a line out the door into the parking lot going all the way? No. And there's a parking lot filled with out-of-state tags, and there might be a drug dealer, too, in the parking lot, somebody selling to somebody else. And then, like, there would be these signs. You know, it would say something like, you know, cash only, Oxy's 30.
All you had to do was go there and look at the place. Now, Cardinals should have seen that, and I believe they did.
Joe believed they knew because he'd already done one case against Cardinal back in 2007. They'd paid a fine, $34 million, and they'd promised to do better monitoring shipments.
This time was more important because they were doing the same things they did the previous time. And this is the time where we said, look, we gave you your chance. You paid a minor fine. Now we're going to hammer you, which is what we should be doing. That's what regulators do.
Joe's preparing his case. This is in the beginning of 2012. He's confident. He's never lost any of the cases he's brought against distributors so far. Then he gets summoned to a meeting at the Department of Justice.
The meeting will be a signal. Things are about to change.
Cases would just sit and languish for weeks, for months, for a year.
The industry pushes back. That's ahead on Reveal.
This episode of Reveal is brought to you in part by Fox Searchlight, presenting the new film Goodbye, Christopher Robin, about Winnie the Pooh author A.A. Milne and his son, whose toys inspired the classic tales, starring Donal Gleeson and Margot Robbie, now playing in select theaters and everywhere November 3rd.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. We're telling the story of pharmaceutical distributors, companies that help flood the black market with pain pills, and the guy at the DEA who tried to stop them. His name is Joe Renazzisi. It's February 2012. Joe has been building a case against one of the biggest companies, Cardinal Health. Joe calls it the case of his dreams. But just as he's preparing to file it, the companies start pushing back. Here's Reveal's Laura Starcheski.
backlash against Joe Ranazzisi would come in waves. Health reporter Lenny Bernstein of The Washington Post describes it this way.
The industry said, okay, we have to fight back. We have to push back on this guy. He is really making our lives miserable. And we begin to see this strategy, which took place in a lot of places, on the Hill, via the Justice Department.
The Justice Department started pushing back against Joe when he was just about to file immediate suspension orders in the Cardinal case to stop some of their shipments. He got summoned to a meeting with top staff at Justice, basically his boss's bosses. Joe says the message he got was, be friendlier to the industry, and we'll be watching you. He filed the Cardinal case anyway.
I just decided that instead of dropping back, we were just going to be a little more aggressive. Maybe a lot more aggressive.
Then, later that year, the DEA hired a new lawyer in charge of reviewing Joe's cases. He'd spent his career at Justice before taking the job.
Within a few weeks, everything had kind of changed. They were turning cases down, or not overtly turning cases down, but basically sitting back and saying, yeah, you got to do the following things before we'll even look at the case. And these are cases, the same types of cases that we've been doing for years.
These weren't just small delays. Scott Higham at The Washington Post says that what Joe described sounded like a massive slowdown.
So they were making these cases, they would send them to Washington, and then the cases would just sit and languish for weeks, for months, for a year. So I said, well, if that's really the case, then I need to go talk to the people who are making the cases.
Scott started digging up contacts for DEA investigators around the country who'd worked under Joe. Jim Geldof in Detroit was one of them.
It seems like everything we submit needs more information, more corroboration, re-interviewing people we've already interviewed 2 and 3 times.
In 2013, Geldof was working on a case against a distributor called Miami Lucan that he found was shipping way too many pills to West Virginia.
They just kept flooding the market. And that was very, very difficult because you had overdose deaths increasing dramatically in West Virginia. And you had a company that's just fueling the market for oxycodone and hydrocodone. And we can't seem to convince people that this is something that needs to be done. And that was very frustrating.
Scott gathered accounts like this from agents in Michigan, Ohio, Georgia. They were only anecdotes, though, showing what happened to a case here, a case there. But he had an ace in the hole, internal DEA records that would show a national pattern.
Okay, so.
Scott pulls out a pile of paper to show me.
Yeah, this pile here, I don't know, it's about 2 inches of documents.
All written by an administrative judge named John Mulrooney, who oversaw all the DEA's cases against distributors. It's a huge stack of his quarterly reports.
And, you know, you just put them in order, in chronological order, and just read them. And then the story starts to kind of, it's like the clouds part, and you can start to see the stars. At the very beginning of these documents, of the time frame that we looked at, you know, he writes these reports saying, this has been a great quarter, you made all these cases, and keep up the good work, you know. And then at a certain point in time, he starts to write in these reports that, you know, the cases are starting to slow down, what's going on, you know, and then the next quarter, it's like, this is stunningly low for a national program, how come we don't have any cases? That we have an epidemic going on. Why are there no cases coming into my judges? What are you guys doing? We were just like, holy crap. You know, this is confirmation, the best kind of confirmation that you can possibly have.
It's not just that these distributors are pouring all these drugs into our cities and towns and turning their heads and ignoring the fact that they're being diverted to the black market. It's worse than that.
Again, Lenny Bernstein.
The DEA, which is supposed to be stopping this, has very dramatically slowed its efforts.
I asked the DEA for an interview about the slowdown so they could explain what happened, but they wouldn't talk about it. They also turned down interviews with The Washington Post. Instead, they sent a statement with a list of their enforcement programs. It said, We have legacy stuff we need to fix, but we now have good folks in place and are moving in the right direction. The slowdown was just the beginning. By the summer of 2014, the pushback against Joe Ranazzisi's team had moved to Capitol Hill. Lawmakers were debating a new bill called the Ensuring Patient Access and Effective Drug Enforcement Act.
I mean, this act basically stops drug enforcement. So even the title is a lie. The title doesn't portray what actually is in the bill. And that's what's horrible.
The bill promised effective drug enforcement, but it would make it harder for Joe to stop those huge shipments of pills. He'd always had to prove the shipments would cause an imminent threat to the public, that the pills would likely end up on the street and people could overdose. Now, the threat would have to be immediate, practically instant, an impossibly high bar.
When a shipment leaves the facility, it might not get to the pharmacy for 2 days, 3 days. That drug might sit on the shelf for another 2 weeks. So according to the new definition, it's no longer an imminent threat because it's not immediate.
People from the industry argued for the law because they said DEA enforcement was too harsh. It was keeping people who actually needed prescription painkillers from getting them. A lawyer named Lyndon Barber made this argument at a 2014 hearing about the bill.
I believe that DEA does care about...
Barber actually used to work with Joe at the DEA. He helped develop Joe's legal strategy against distributors. Then, in 2011, he switched sides. He started working at a private law firm that represents the distributors, including Cardinal.
Certainly, I do believe, and as a longtime DEA employee, I've been gone for 2.5 years, I believe the agency cares about patient access. But again, it's the unintended consequences. Mr. Ranazzisi testified previously, and knowing him, he's a pharmacist, he does care about patient access. I'm just not convinced that the way the agency handles enforcement activities contemplates all of the unintended consequences in the supply chain.
Lyndon Barber should have known that DEA does cases based on established case law. This idea, this storyline that legitimate patients are not getting their medicine or there's unintended consequences when thousands of people are dying is an outrage, and he should know better than that.
It turns out Lyndon Barber didn't just argue for the law. According to a Justice Department email Scott and Lenny got a hold of, he helped craft it. We tried to talk to him about it, but he declined. And Barber wasn't the only one from Joe's team to switch sides. Here's Scott again.
We found, without really even looking that hard, that there were at least, I think, like 30 or 31 people, senior people from that division, that were recruited by these very same companies and were installed in very key positions, and some of them in legal positions. So they knew the DEA's legal strategy. They have the keys to the kingdom.
Joe tried to fight the bill. He spoke up on a conference call with lawmakers. There's no recording of the call, but he remembers saying he didn't like the bill because it would protect companies that were defendants in DEA cases. After the call, Tom Marino, the Republican congressman from Pennsylvania who sponsored the bill, showed up at a hearing on Capitol Hill. He called out Joe and his entire strategy against the distributors.
Big fines make headlines, but that is all they do. Press releases do not save lives. It is my understanding that Joe Ranazzisi, a senior DEA official, has publicly accused we sponsors of the bill of, quote, supporting criminals, unquote. This offends me immensely.
A week later, Marino wrote a letter accusing Joe of serious misconduct and intimidating members of Congress. The Office of the Inspector General at the Justice Department launched an investigation. While Marino's bill was being debated, the drug industry spent millions of dollars lobbying Congress. It finally passed last year. it practically neutralizes the DEA's ability to go after distributors.
The public was sold a bill of goods. Somebody, somewhere, used influence to get this piece of trash through. And the only people that didn't benefit from it is the public and public health and safety.
Tom Marino refused multiple interview requests, but Lenny and Scott and a 60 Minutes crew went to his office to try to talk to him.
Hi. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I'm Bill Whitaker. Not film us, please.
We'd just like to speak with the congressman.
Are you filming?
I was, yes.
His staffers told them to get the camera out, and then they called the Capitol Police.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How we doing?
We're doing well. How are you?
All right. We got a report of a camera crew barging away into a congressional office, trying to get a statement or a report or something.
I wouldn't say barging in.
I've been covering Washington on and off for 30 years. I've never had anybody call the police on me before, anywhere. Never mind a member of Congress.
Nothing ever came of the Inspector General's investigation into Joe, by the way. But at the DEA, Joe's office was moved down the hall, away from the action.
Between the investigations and the fact that I wasn't getting anything done, because of the attorneys, it just got to a point where it wasn't working. Nothing was working anymore.
Joe was replaced and pushed out. He retired in October of 2015. And the cases against the distributors, there have been very few since then. Here's Scott.
It's kind of come to a halt. A lot of people in the DEA, a lot of the people who are in this diversion world feel like they've lost, that the corporations have won and that they have lost, that the amount of influence that these companies have in Washington with members of Congress, with people who used to work for the DEA and the Justice Department, who are now lobbyists, have put an enormous amount of pressure on the Department of Justice and the DEA to knock it off. And meanwhile, the deaths continue to rise. The cases continue to either fall or stagnate.
Joe says he keeps meaning to fix up his old guitars in the basement and start playing again. But even though he's technically retired, he hasn't really had time for that.
The one thing that's going to stop this is if one of these corporations takes a major legal hit, and that's the way it'll stop.
Since Joe wasn't able to stop the opioid crisis from inside the DEA, he's now trying to help stop it from the outside. He's advising several teams of lawyers who are going after the distributors. They're planning to sue the opioid industry on behalf of several states for the harm they've caused. One lawsuit has already been filed on behalf of the Cherokee Nation. Joe hopes the companies will be made to pay for the devastation the epidemic has brought to countless cities and towns across America, and that somehow he can make up for all the truckloads of pills he couldn't hold back when he worked for the DEA.
I'm not going away. I'm just not going to go away. A lot of people died under my watch, and I'm just not. I have to live with that every day.
Laura Starczewski produced that story with our partners at The Washington Post and 60 Minutes. Since the beginning of the opioid epidemic, almost 200,000 people have died of prescription drug overdoses. That's more than three times the number of American soldiers killed in the Vietnam War. In response to a version of this story from The Washington Post and 60 Minutes, there have been a few developments. One about Tom Marino, the congressman who called the cops on Lenny and Scott when they were trying to get answers about his pro-industry law. President Trump had nominated him to be his drug czar, in charge of the National Office of Drug Control Policy. Marino has now pulled his name from consideration. Another development, lawmakers are now proposing bills that would essentially reverse Marino's law, once again making it possible for the DEA to slow the flow of pills from distributors. When we come back, the story of one overdose, a video diary, and the widow who found it after her husband died.
I'm about to start watching some of the videos. I'm nervous, I'm a little anxious, but I need to watch them because I need to know.
This is Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. On May 22nd, 2015, Daniel Cousins died of a fentanyl overdose. He was 31. Like a lot of people who overdose, he had switched from heroin to fentanyl, a cheaper, stronger, and much more dangerous synthetic opioid. Dan was originally from England, but he moved to Portsmouth, New Hampshire to be with his wife, Jennifer. He was a runner, a vegan who loved animals, and an assistant manager at a local bank. Jennifer had confronted Dan many times about his drug use. Their marriage was under tremendous strain. They were actually separated when he died, but they talked every day, and Jennifer was fighting to save his life. She lost that fight, but after he died, Jennifer found something he left behind. Dan had made a video diary on his phone.
The last month of his life really is what we have as a snapshot, a video snapshot, a video diary of the last month of Dan Cousins' life.
8 months after her husband's death, Jennifer sat down with Dan's phone and started watching.
Okay. Am I recording? Yeah, I'm recording. Okay. Here we go. I'm sitting here in my bedroom in my house, and I'm about to start watching some of the videos that Dan made on his phone. I kind of refer to them as his heroin diaries. I'm nervous. I'm a little anxious. I don't know what he's going to say, but I need to watch them because I need to know.
Hi, my name's Dan. You know, I've tried keeping diaries before, but I've never been very good at them. So I thought I'd keep a video diary. I don't know how long it's going to last, but the reason why I'm keeping a video diary is I was recently diagnosed with major depression, and I also suffer from quite a lot of anxiety.
I still can't figure out how he made that jump. Like, he didn't start with pot or, you know, any of the more mild drugs, if you can even call them that. He just started using heroin.
Like, all the time, my brain is like this freaking like conference room of people yelling at each other, all different things, and it's changing constantly. And then you just know that there's something, and it's just gonna silence it, and you can just be yourself and smile. And but of course, I don't want to be, you know, a drug addict. It's like,
as soon as I started watching it, I could tell that.
I mean, for many reasons,
he was under the influence because his pupils were pinpoint.
Oh, where was I? So today's like the 3rd of May, 2015. It was a super nice day, like warm and sunny, and my eyes are like pinpricks.
He kind of goes from speaking.
Maybe they're not.
Kind of slowly, like he's really sleepy.
Huh. Isn't that the strangest thing? Anyway.
And then he'll just kind of have a burst of words.
I'm having a gin and tonic. So that should level me out a bit.
When he's nice under the influence and he kind of drifts off.
So.
But he has like conversations with himself.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And I wonder what that is.
And I think that's what all these kind of guys don't get. Bam. You're dead.
And all these videos so far have been taken in the apartment. And he's got Brady on his lap.
Just got Brady, my cat, my little kitty cat, jumping on my lap. Brady, smile for the camera. What a good boy. Yay. Good night. I did like 3 reasonable lines, you know. I am feeling pretty freaking awesome.
I didn't know who to call. I told my mom. I called his doctor. I called a crisis line.
I'm not a heroin addict. And I know that I've been taking it way too much recently, so.
Like, he straight up says he's not an addict. And at that point, I mean, is it even possible to be like a casual heroin user? I mean, really?
I don't know. I might just cut back, or I might just stop taking it altogether. I don't really see the difference between like heroin or like drinking or smoking.
Seriously. Seriously. I don't really know. Seriously. I mean, come on. Like, Dan,
you know,
you're not an idiot. Like, you. I don't know. I'm getting. I don't know. It's like I'm talking to him. Like, it's heroin. Heroin.
Just like helps me chill out. And right now I'm very chilled out. So I'm going to eat my breakfast, drink my coffee, and stop making a fool out of myself on camera. Bye-bye.
I talked to him every day. I posted notes around the apartment telling him how much I loved him and how dangerous this drug was. And how I would do anything that he needed me to do to help him get better and quit and get sober. Every day I asked him, are you ready to quit? And he'd say, no. I don't know. I feel sick to my stomach. I feel like I've been punched in the gut. I feel like I've just had like a mega dose of Danny tonight. And that was just. That was quite the video.
I remember the last week of his life. It was Sunday night.
It is Sunday, 17th of May, 11:55 p.m.
And I just casually asked him, you know, are you still using? And he's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, man, I'm using this stuff called China White. And the way he said it to me, it was almost like he would expect me to know what China White was.
I drove to Boston when I scored, and I got some China White.
Like, what is that? And he said, oh, it's heroin and fentanyl together. It's awesome. Like, he was saying how great it was.
Why doesn't everyone do this all of the time?
Like, heroin itself, yeah, bad. Heroin, fentanyl, all the red flags and everything were going off.
Ooh, there goes the vision. I just took some more China White. I took a bit too much earlier, like, you know, what they call it, a minor overdose. So, like, I was, like, had to concentrate on my breathing, kind of went into the bedroom, like, passed out on the bed, woke up, Brady's licking my forehead, I'm, like, drenched.
He was going to overdose, like, that it was going to kill him. I just knew.
Oh, my God. And I'm thinking, like... I could overdose and die. I don't really give a f-. I really don't. Okay, so here we are, Tuesday, May 19th at 8 something. I'm driving to work. I've only had a few sips of coffee so far this morning.
And then the very last video that he made was May 19th, so the next morning around 8:45, and he's in his car driving to work.
Video anyway, I suppose I just wanted to remind myself that I'm a guy in a suit with a professional job getting up early and driving to work, because I appreciate, like, the last few entries that I made last night were of me, like, stoned and looking like some kind of a junkie.
And then he starts talking about how he looks fat and old.
Fat and old, which is weird because, like, I know that I'm putting on a bit of weight, but old, like, old, I've never really looked at myself. You know, I'm 31 years old. I've never really looked at myself and thought, like, you're old. And then I start to see things like little lines or just, I don't know, oldness. And I'm not.
He definitely aged a lot the last few months of his life because I think of his drug use and the stress.
My age.
Of course, I still thought he was super handsome.
Anyway, I better concentrate on driving. And chat later. Bye-bye.
Yeah, so that was the last video that he made on the 19th. And I saw him for the last time on the 21st. We had some supper. I made him tacos. And then he died that night.
New Hampshire 911, what is your emergency?
My husband's dead.
Okay,
he's laying on the couch and he's cold and he's dead.
Okay, ma'am, are you with him now?
Yes.
Ma'am, is he awake?
No.
Is he breathing?
I'm a nurse. Okay. I know. No, he's not breathing. He's got foam in his mouth.
Okay, ma'am, I'm sending for the Portsmouth Police and Ambulance to help you now. Stay on the line. I'll tell you exactly what to do next.
Oh, my God. Daddy!
Please, small fire in the control. Be clear shortly. Point to dispatch.
911 agent 127 with a request for police and ambulance. This will be at 42 Beachstone.
Oh my God, there's so much stuff. I just realized one day, like, yeah, okay, I'm ready to look at the stuff. I'm ready to go through it. His clothing, he has a lot of clothes, and they've all just been in bags in my front bedroom. And you walk in the room and you could smell him because it's his clothing, so it was kind of strange. I noticed the cats like to sleep on the bags. Want some food? Want some treats? All right, Brady usually, he's really cute. He can stand on his back feet. Come on. He'll just kind of take it from you. I'm scared. I don't want to erase him. He's always a part of me, and I'm always going to have, you know, some things to remember him by. But I also don't want, like, my house to become a giant shrine to Danny, you know? Today is Monday, May 22nd, 2017. And today is 2 years that Danny's been gone. So I'm here to visit this place that he loved a lot, the Great Bay Wildlife Refuge. We both would visit a lot. We'd come together probably once a week. And I haven't been here since he died. And I'm here to come and visit and be in nature, and also to sprinkle a very small amount of his ashes when I find a good spot. See all the little baby trees, all the little new growth. It's nice. Everything's so green. I don't know, no place is good enough. I feel like no place is good enough, but you like to look at the water here. I think this is a good spot to leave a tiny little bit of Danny. I think he'd like it here. Well, Danny, I miss you. There. Okay, I know that was a tiny amount, but I want to hold on to the rest of him for now.
Dan Cousins was one of more than 52,000 Americans who died from overdoses in 2015. The story about Dan and his wife Jen was produced by Jack Rodolico in collaboration with New Hampshire Public Radio. The number of overdose deaths continues to rise, up an estimated 21% last year alone. We want to close the hour with someone who's doing all she can to preserve life in the face of this crushing epidemic. Jan Rader is one of the subjects of a new Netflix documentary, Heroin, produced as part of our Glassbreaker film series. Jan is the fire chief in Huntingdon, West Virginia, where overdose deaths are 10 times the national average.
It's sad when you can drive around the city and say, oh, somebody died there, you know, but that's the reality of this area.
I started my conversation with Jen by asking why the opioid problem has hit Huntington so hard.
You have a lot of blue-collar workers. We're hardworking people, you know, so I think that physicians would give pain medicine for back injuries and knee problems just to get people back to work so that they didn't lose any money. And we ended up with a large percentage of the population addicted to opiates.
Jen says that when prescription drugs got harder to find, people turned to heroin and then more recently, fentanyl.
You can't get into him?
Not the door. He fell against the doors here. He fell up against the door.
Okay. Do you know, is he a known user or?
Well, this is the second time this week he's OD'd. Third floor, on the left, all the way down, the door's open.
Okay. Fire department.
Time after time in the film, I watched Jan and fellow first responders save overdose victims with a drug called naloxone. It's a pretty amazing thing to see.
Try to rock him forward so you can scoot in here enough.
What's his name?
1 minute, they're barely breathing, blue in the face. The next, they're sitting up talking.
Ooh, there we go. Oh. Hey.
All right.
To what hospital you want to go to, bud?
Capital, I guess.
Okay. I asked Jan if it's difficult to keep naloxone in supply.
There's been a little price gouging over the time with this epidemic. You know, a 2-milligram vial that you can use nasally will run right around $50. Mm-hmm. You know, it gets expensive, but we need to continue to save people until we can get them into recovery, though.
Even if it means saving the same person over and over again. That's what happened with a man named Mickey.
I was on him at least 4 times. At the time, I was a shift commander on 1 shift, and we have 3 shifts. So he told me he's overdosed more than a dozen times.
Eventually, Mickey was able to find his way back into a treatment program and get clean. There's a powerful moment in the film when he and Jan are walking along the riverbank, handing out food, supplies, and naloxone to addicts living in a homeless encampment. Jan is talking about how overdose rates are up across the county.
2015 was 70 in the county. It's going to be higher.
You know, last year was the first year I haven't been a part of that number.
I never thought of it that way.
I didn't either until you were just sitting there talking. I was thinking, you know what? Wow. Since I've lived in Huntington, there hasn't been a year gone by I haven't been a part of the overdose number.
Wow.
Yeah. I didn't think that was possible.
I asked Jan what it means to her that Mickey was able to get clean.
Meeting Mickey and dealing with Mickey has been one of the most humbling parts of my life. Here you have a man standing beside you who's suffered from addiction for so many years. And, you know, now he's a tax-paying working citizen and he's raising his 4 children and he's in their lives and he wasn't before. And he doesn't want his children to grow up like he did. So things can change. Lives can change.
What exactly do you want to see from the federal government and the state to help with this epidemic?
We have a community here in West Virginia that is willing to go above and beyond. We have created some things that work with virtually no money, and I think that funneling money to areas like Huntington will help solve this for the whole country.
Because you see hope in all of this.
I do. I do. Here's a beautiful thing about this. We have nowhere to go but up. You know what? There's no fear of failure here. We as a society want an easy fix. Well, that doesn't happen. This problem didn't arrive here overnight. It's not going to leave overnight. But we have to be willing to face the facts that it's here. It's going to take us a while, and we can't back down.
Jan, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, my friend. You have a safe day.
You too. Jan Rader is the fire chief in Huntington, West Virginia. She's one of the subjects of our Netflix documentary, Heroin, directed by Elaine McMillian Sheldon. Our show was edited by Suzanne Reber and Deb George. Laura Starcheski helped edit and was our lead producer. Thanks to Jeff Lean, David Fallis, Alice Lee, and Ira Rosen for help in our collaboration with The Washington Post and 60 Minutes. We had production help from WHYY in Philadelphia. Our lead sound designer and engineer is Jim Briggs. He had help this week from Catherine Raimondo and Kat Shuknit. Amy Powell's our editor-in-chief. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson. And remember, there is always more to the story.